Okay, this is talking with... Is it Edward or Edwin?
Edward.
Edward Purcell on 16 November 77 at the University of Washington. Now, I'd like to go back to World War II when you were working in the radiation lab, and you were actually leader of the group that Dickey was working in also. And in particular, do you have any memories as to hearing about radio-astronomical sort of things in terms of haze discovery and this sort of thing?
Well, not so much that, but we were, there were two things. In the first place, Dickey developed the radiometer there, right in that group. It was used very heavily to study the water vapor absorption, which we blundered into in Cavan. And we also, Dickey did use it for other interesting things. He looked at a partial eclipse of the sun with it.
Right.
And he also was able to establish the, he also measured the temperature just looking out in space.
Got an upper limit for it.
Got an upper limit, as I recall, around 20 or 25 degrees K.
Yeah.
Something he himself later forgot.
What was the original reason to build this radiometer?
I'm not quite sure just how it started, but Dickey was interested in the lock-in amplifier was a great thing then, you see, and he was working sort of off on his own on things connected with signal to noise and one thing and another, and I can't remember just. You'd have to ask him about it. I really can't. But I can remember vividly when he had it working, we all went down there. Before it was even an antenna thing, we went down there and you could hold a cigarette at the end of the waveguide and the meter would go off scale, you know.
So it wasn't a driving military reason then?
No. In fact, you see, my group was kind of an odd group that had a sort of a freewheeling license to try things that were far out or anything, anything like that. Though at the same time we were engaged in developing the K-band radar techniques.
But the water vapor absorption line wasn't known when K-band was set up.
We should have known better because we could have known about it if we'd only read one of Van's papers. And I remember very vividly myself going down to a meeting at Columbia. See, Columbia Radiation Lab was making their magnetrons, and the magnetrons were coming out at various frequencies. And it was time that we settled down and said, let's have a target frequency so the plumbing and the magnetron and the LOs are all met. So we had a little meeting down at Columbia to decide which number we were going to pick.
Right. About what year was this now?
This would have been 1943, I should guess. And we picked 1.25 centimeters for no very special reason except that, I just don't want to miss Ernie, but he'll see the lights in there. For no very special reason, except that some tubes had been coming out fairly close to that. We were using quarter inch by half inch OD waveguide, which worked all right, didn't have to. And it made a quarter wavelength an eighth of an inch, which is kind of crazy. We would have been a lot better off if we had taken the water. If we'd known about the water line, what we really should have done was to pick a longer wavelength, not a shorter one. It would have made everything easier. We could have still had a gain. If we picked, say, 1.6, we would have still had a factor of 2 over X-band in resolution,
right.
And we would have been in there.
But in fact, there was very little K-band radar.
That's right. And in fact, as far as the radar application were concerned, it wouldn't have made all that much difference because K-band, by its very nature, was adapted for rather short-range applications. It just gave us a bad name with the military because, you know, they thought it was terrible that there was attenuation. Well, it wasn't all that large, you know. And the applications that could have been done in K-band wouldn't have been all that much different. But at any rate, it led to a feverish activity in measuring this with Dickey's radiometer. Willis Lamb at Columbia made an copper-lined echo room in which he could put steam, and he had festooned with columns of bolometers hanging from the ceiling. And so he'd pulse in with a magnetron into the echo room, and then the heating of the bolometers, of course, would depend on how long the energy rattled around. And Cush wound up about 200 feet of waveguide and tried to just brute force measure the attenuation in water vapor in the waveguide, which then wasn't a terribly good idea. And Dickey did it very nicely. We did taking tilting curves through the atmosphere, and they went to Florida, and they'd fly radio sondes to get them. At the same time, Southworth at Homedale in Bell Labs, mm-hmm. was sort of interested in looking at the sun and things right. like that. And of course, Dickie looked at the sun at K-Band. The thing that I did not know about at the time was the sort of long wave Jansky type stuff that I just hadn't paid any attention to.
Why was it that no one at the Rad Lab did what Southworth did essentially during the war?
Oh, Southworth didn't do anything terribly interesting. He just
well, he measured the antenna temperature you get from the sun in a couple of different
wavelengths. Well, so did we. So did we. Yeah.
But now, all I'm aware of is what Dickie did just at the end of the war. Now, did you do that during the war in some unpublished report or something like this?
Oh, you mean? Oh well, I don't know. Southworth measured the antenna temperature of the sun at S band or something like that.
Yeah.
Didn't he? Yeah.
And I think at 3 and 10 centimeters.
Yeah. Well, we were, we wouldn't have been excited as very much. It was a nice thing, and you know, but there are so many things to do that were equally interesting.
But there is no unpublished report or anything like this of any measurements. Do you know of any other things in Rad Lab reports or something that might bear on radio astronomy that I might not have seen?
No, but I think it's important to recall another aspect of the whole situation. We had an enormous group of people who were working on microwave propagation. And the reason being that it had been discovered that microwaves can be trapped and ducted and bent around the Earth, especially mm-hmm. over the ocean. That problem was considered very important for the military applications, and an enormous amount of effort was put into it, both mm-hmm. experimental and theoretical. So it turned out that the trapping was due to a very shallow, very low-level gradient in water vapor that you would get. The first few hundred feet would make a linear gradient in index, mm-hmm. and in this index you could have a gradient, you could have a waveguide that would carry it. Mm-hmm. So the theory of this was just worked on by all sorts of theoretical people and computers. Yeah, Ernie! This was absorbing a tremendous effort. In fact, the Mark I computer at Harvard, the famous Mark I, spent most of its time calculating Bessel's functions of order 1/3, which is what you have to work with if you're trying to solve this particular problem. But now, I mention this because at the end of the war, there were some obvious things that one might do going back into scientific life. You see, we were all concerned with that. What should we do? There were so many things we could do. We had so many new tools. One of the natural, sort of obvious things to have done was to continue this work on anomalous propagation, mm-hmm. which was well funded by the military, and the problem was sort of half solved, and, you know, and all this stuff. But the smart people didn't do that. In fact, in particular, Bowen went down to Australia to head up the CSIRO division. It absolutely had nothing to do with propagation. I told him one time, Taffy, I admire your intelligence not for so much for what you did in Australia as for what you didn't do, because that was a problem that one should have turned his back on. Absolutely no interest anymore, completely dead drunk. So they went down there and they started measuring, using the Lloyd's mirror interferometer right. on the cliff to measure the solar thing.
I've talked with many of them, including
that's
Bowen.
That's right.
What other fields did you consider to go into civilian life to?
Oh, well, as far as I'm concerned, by that time I already had so much physics lined up to do with other things, including nuclear magnetic resonance, you see, which we actually did before I officially left radiation.
But, so that was one. What others do you remember in the field, in the group?
Well, people wanted, of course, to go into back to nuclear physics. There was the, many people went into, one field that was ready to roll, of course, was microwave spectroscopy.
Right.
And that went on very fast because we had the tubes, we had the interest, we had already done microwave spectroscopy, not only the Dickie stuff with water vapor, but we'd looked at the ammonia, old famous mm-hmm. ammonia line in the waveguide and so on. So everybody, that was just ducks ready to go.
Do you remember at all anybody thinking of radio astronomy besides Bowen?
No, I don't particularly. No, I really, really don't. Bob Berenger had some nice ideas toward the end, applications of things like the oxygen line, that never thought much about radio astronomy. He didn't go into it. No, we just didn't know much about it, really. Well, in the first place, you might ask, were there any astronomers there? Which is...
But of course, they weren't in the labs in England and Australia during the war, either.
Well, but we had some astronomers.
Oh, you even... Oh, yeah, I see. Red
Lab. Oh, sure. In fact, we had, not in my group,
yeah,
but at Radiation Lab, we had... well, John Hall, for one, was at Radiation Lab. Mm-hmm. But even more important, see his face, I can't say his name, now retired director of the Lick, as it was, you know.
Of Lick?
No,
I think I know. Whitford.
Whitford, Al,
yes,
Whitford.
I've seen
yeah, no, he was in the RF group,
mm-hmm,
and one of the leading figures. And I think there were a couple more astronomers in there, but they went back into astronomy.
But optical astronomers.
Now that was it. There was no real couple.
So I might then ask you the question of, what are your thoughts on why American radio astronomy just didn't go anywhere until really, really the late 50s, early 60s?
Nobody really. I don't think there's any real theory about it. History is a series of accidents to some extent. Mm-hmm. Didn't
strike anyone's fancy.
Didn't have the man to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody.
Okay. Well, let's move on then to.
I think it really. I would have expected, you say, if it had to, where would I have expected it to happen? I think I would have expected it to happen to Bell Labs, because they were very much concerned still, and they thought about things in a very fundamental way.
They had the history of Jansky.
And they had the history of Jansky, and they had marvelously equipped to go ahead. But they had other things. Everybody had other fish to fry.
Although it is true that they didn't really go let Jansky go with his thing. There's a debate as to whether he wanted to. But well, let's move on to the hydrogen line. As I mentioned to you, I've heard the other view very much and looked into it, and I'm anxious to hear yours. My fundamental question is, how did you get into the idea of detecting it in interstellar regions? I could see where you wanted to interest it from an NMR point of view.
No. Well, it came about as follows. I think you can check this with Doc, but my memory is as following. That Doc Ewan had come to me with looking for a thesis problem, and we had talked about, he was interested, he thought, in doing something maybe about the upper atmosphere with microwaves.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted to do it with microwaves and hadn't anything to do with the nuclear resonance stuff at all. That was a completely separate part of my activity. Then Doc already knew a little bit of astronomy. He had taught a navigation during the war to a lot of the... He'd been in a young kid. In fact, he was a good pal of a number of players on the Red Sox, Johnny Pesky and Ted Williams, because he taught them navigation when they were getting
there.
But he knew that, you know, that kind of astronomy pretty well, and he had a lot of enthusiasm. So in the middle of this discussion, Doc went off to an astronomy meeting somewhere. I don't know where it was, New York or New Haven or someplace. And there were some people there he knew, and he's very jolly, gregarious fellow. He came back and he said, you know, somebody at the meeting was talking about maybe one could detect a hyperfine line from hydrogen in space. Well, the hyperfine line was sort of familiar to me from the Columbia work, which of course I'd been following.
Can you remember what year this was?
Well, it must have been certainly, I should think, 49, perhaps not earlier than that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, well, that's interesting. Let's see if we could calculate whether it could be done. So I did some calculations and looked like, you know, maybe. And I looked up some of this stuff about the interstellar gas and read a little bit of, I read one of Spitzer's papers, I think, about where he estimated the temperature, you know, of the gas from indirect evidence. Turned out to be about right. And So we...
Did you hunt up Vanderhulst's original article?
No, because, you see, at that point, I didn't know that the name Vanderhulst at that time had not come into it at all. Doc didn't even know where this had come from. He just came back and sort of said people were talking about
this. I see.
On the other hand, of course, I'm quite certain that it traces back directly to Vanderhulst.
That's why they were talking about it. You're probably talking about the Dutch effort.
Sure. There's no question in my mind that if you switch Vanderhulst in and out, that our experiment would go along with it. But we didn't at that time. And in fact, I don't know whether this was as late as when they'd actually begun, but I think it was just that somebody had mentioned it as kind of amusing possibility. So then we said, well, let's try it. And Doc was thoroughly warned by me, and of course didn't need to be warned, that it was a really risky thing, that if you don't find it, you're going to have a real job ahead of you, because then you've got to really measure everything and put on strong limits. So that, in fact, he did an extremely good job, and although our horn was very simple, it was as good as it produced as much signal as it could have, and the electronics was really excellent, and I think actually better than the Dutch receiver at that time. I think Doc will tell you that, and I think he's correct. We had a calibration of the noise figure made with the fluorescent tube that Mumford had developed at Bell at Homedale.
I have some pictures here which
boggle
your mind.
We have some wonderful ones. I have got color stereo pictures of
the same thing.
And there's Doc just standing in the room in 3D, it's really very uncanny.
I love this one where it says meter hot.
Yeah,
showed us how it was just all hooked together, and you weren't trying to be fancy. You know, just get a good setup.
It was all done in that big waveguide. And then you don't have the one that shows a noise source. But it was a well-calibrated thing. So
from a technical point of view, was it just a matter of doing everything very well, or were there some differences that hadn't really been done before?
Well, of course, now everything that we did looks so old hat, it's so common. It was a frequency switching.
That was something different.
That was something different, but Doc decided on that quite early, frequency switching. And it was really very carefully measured, you know, everything. We knew what our noise figure was, and we knew where we were going.
But it was off-the-shelf components.
Well, it was off-the-shelf. Is mostly off other people's shelves. He was great at scrounging things, and the total expense for the whole damn thing, you know, was really ridiculous. He knew how to get things out of the Navy, you know what I mean?
Do you think there's possibly any record of some feasibility calculations that you might have done?
I'm sure I have not a scrap of that, and I doubt if Doc has. It would be I think I made most of the first calculations, though I'm sure he did them too. But you can ask him that. Mm-hmm. It may be that he's kept something as possible. I have not.
Okay.
I'm sure I haven't done a scrap. So.
But you said you were basing it on the Spitzer, the latest Spitzer
I had,
paper.
I can't remember at what point that I got that, started reading about the thing, to learn about the temperature. An interesting point later, of course, is that we didn't, at that time, even after we had the line, we did not realize what the main spin temperature setting mechanism is, namely the spin exchange,
yes, right,
that George and I eventually wrote the paper about. And that came up in a rather amusing place. We had, in those days, a Thursday night joint seminar with physics at MIT. It always happened at Harvard, but we had a certain little lecture room where we had a very informal sort of knockdown, drag-out seminar. And sometime, it must have been, in the spring of 52, I guess, I gave the seminar talk that night on the 21-centimeter observation. So. This was a seminar where everybody was very rude, you know, they'd interrupt you or anything like this. And I was patiently explaining, calculating the radiation time and calculating the equilibrium time to show that the spin temperature was going to be the kinetic temperature and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, there's various processes here, and I calculated the spontaneous emission time. So, And all the time I was doing this, Norman Ramsey and Vicki Weisskopf were sitting together in the front row, and they were jabbering back and forth with one another in very coarse whispers. You see, I finally got annoyed, and I stopped. I said, "What are you guys talking about?" They said, "Wouldn't spin exchange be more important?" And as soon as they said it, pretty obviously.
But I got the impression that the spin exchange really wasn't worked out until after the discovery of the line.
That's right. No, we already had the line.
I mean, but the... I see, so that was the beginning of working out the...
That was the beginning of working it out. As soon as they said it, you could see that all you had to say is that during a collision, there is a reasonable probability, not small compared to one, for spin exchange, and then, of course...
So that's what led to your 1952 FJ paper.
That's right. Then you know that that's got to be it.
I see.
So I was always... I always get it... Vicki and Norman, somebody was going to write a paper and put down asterisk publicly communicated by.
Okay, going back to the discovery of the line, can you characterize for me the role of you versus Ewan in this experiment?
Oh, Doc did, not to say he did all the work is an understatement and really doesn't do him justice. He not only did all the work, but he understood everything, and he kept going, and thought of... I was at that stage when the electronics, I was just essentially an interested observer with whom he could discuss his problems and who could try to think them out. In fact, I wasn't there looking at the record when it came in, because it was 2 or 3 a.m. then that it was coming, the Milky Way was coming past in March. And the thing I remember is, Doc, I came in next morning, and on my desk there was either a roll of Esterline Angus, or Doc was there saying, "I think I got a thesis."
Uh-huh.
And we went upstairs and we took the Esterline Angus and we rolled it out the length of the hall and got down and sighted down it, you see, which is the way you integrated your signal.
Right.
And it looked pretty real. But then, of course, we weren't absolutely sure until
the receiver drifter.
It was pretty good. And you'll see the original record. You know, wasn't too bad. But then, when it moved in frequency and in time, the way it should have, then of course it was.
Right.
But I had to have Doc. Doc was the guy who knew what galactic coordinates were, knew what Declan, I didn't even know about the right ascension and declination.
Well, that's something I can ask right now. The famous horn stuck out the window at minus 5 deck. Was it simply because that was a handy way to put the horn, or were you actually picking a declination?
No, we picked it. That's a good declination to look and let the Milky Way go past.
It could be any number of ones, but
sure.
I was just wondering...
We had to clear. We couldn't have it too low, or we'd hit another building. It wasn't too high.
And you didn't want to put it too high, because then you're looking at from the galactic center.
That's right. Yeah. So it was reasonable. Just out on the parapet, over the front door alignment. And
now, at what point did you become aware of the von der Holst paper and the Dutch effort and so forth?
Well, it must have been, of course, in between. Because von der Holst then came to Harvard, and then we were in complete touch. About it.
But you weren't part of his coming there or anything?
No.
And so he found out about your experiment, and then, like you say, you were in touch.
Yes. My memory's poor on that, but I believe that Doc can fill you in on that better, because I think he was more closely involved in between, and he had talked to von der Holst more than I had at that particular point.
Well, the thing that's always struck me is the beautiful exchange that took place, and not spin exchange, but exchange of astrophysics for techniques. And I'd be interested if you'd agree with this, namely that the Dutch did not have this frequency switching technique, which of course is vital to get these low signals. On the other hand, it's my understanding that that your experiment, you were only going to switch a few kilohertz, which would have subtracted. You were thinking of only a naturally broadened line, not of a Doppler shift due to a couple hundred Kelvin gas, and that you would have missed the line for that reason, and that von der Holst was the one that pointed that out.
That may well be. That's a point I have simply blanked out on, but you may well be right, and it would be a very interesting point to... Now, again, I think that Doc will be able to
This is mainly for Van der Hulst studies.
Yeah, now that may be right. And I just can't testify to it. I wouldn't have, you know, that point's gone from my memory. Maybe I dropped it for Freudian reasons, but you'll have to ask Don about that.
Do you remember anything else that Van der Hulst contributed to the experiment?
No.
From your you wouldn't be better to ask.
Yes, I don't think there was anything else, but that may have been a very important item. If the line had been, of course, you know, 10 times weaker, we would have missed it too.
Yeah, sure.
Wouldn't have taken much more than that to.
Well, along the same line, Frank Kerr happened to be there getting a master's degree at that time. Do you remember at all the interaction between Kerr and your group?
Not especially. I really can't pull
The Australians were not working actively like the Dutch were. But nevertheless, once you did discover the line, you notified them as well as the Dutch, I believe.
I think Frank, whether we did or whether Frank got the message back.
I think it was the latter.
Frank came up to our celebration. I'm so hazy on that.
But could you tell me?
I remember our feeling, you know, this is a question we started out. We didn't know whether we'd see the line in the mission or absorption.
Right. Which you discuss in this.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And that seemed to be. There's early. Maybe I did.
Now, so what was your real motivation in notifying the other groups after you made the discovery? This is continuing, by the way, on 17 November.
Well, I really can't. Remember directly, you know, I would have to go back and sort of imagine what it was almost, so it's not very good history. But we were, first of all, we were, of course, very well aware by then of the Dutch work and of the really central role of Van der Hulst in generating the idea in the first place. So it was clearly, we had clearly some obligation to acknowledge their important position in it. In fact, as I guess you probably learned from them, if they hadn't had a fire in the antenna or something, they might well have anticipated us, in which case we would have had really nothing to claim much credit for. And then in the case of the Australians, I felt, so again, a personal connection because Taffy Bowen, among others, was a good friend of mine. I'd worked with him during the war. And Frank Kerr was there, so that it was just that I don't know. Of course, in a way, you might say it was a sign of a lack of confidence in that. If we went out on a limb just on our own without, and then it turned out that, you know, it was just a glitch in the receiver or something. Mm-hmm. I don't think that was very much of it, although I can't prove it. I think it was just that our personal associations, one way or another, with these people and their, particularly the important role of the Dutch in the whole thing.
So as you recall, you were quite confident about the reality of the signal and so forth. So
I think we were very confident after it had moved properly in frequency and time.
Well, maybe this is a good stage to ask you a couple specific questions about the article in Nature. you mentioned here a detector and a narrow 0.016 cycles per second filter. Was that essentially an integration constant then of the inverse of that, of 60 seconds?
Yeah, that was the post-detection integration time. That was just essentially what we would call then a lock-in system.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. But this was only a single channel, which you were sweeping in frequency.
That's right. That's right. It wasn't.
And
It was rather interesting that this term spin temperature, which you say here for want of a better name, of course,
became the standard in the field.
Let's see, what else?
I'm not sure that we hadn't already used that term in NMR at that point. That's an interesting question. I'm not quite clear. See this. I'm not sure whether that may have been.
That would be interesting to know.
It was before our negative temperature experiments when we began thinking of spin temperature in a very concrete way.
What were you doing to base the frequency you expected the line on in terms of the galactic Doppler shift? Were you looking up the rotation of the Milky Way and expecting a certain shift, or were you just going to search over quite a large band and see where it came up? Do you remember?
No, I honestly don't remember. I wonder, let's see, what the direction in galactic coordinates was.
Well, it was about L equals 30 or 40 degrees, modern galactic coordinates. And in fact, you found a shift of something like 150 kilohertz.
Yeah.
But something I should mention, I'm not, probably you're aware, is that your switching of 75 kilohertz, although it was much better than what von der Hult says that you apparently want to do, nevertheless was not sufficient for
that's
the broad
right.
galactic
right.
line. So the peak you got was simply the strongest peak, and you missed a large baseline sort of thing.
Yes.
But nevertheless, I checked this out. It is quite consistent with later measurements in this in this direction.
But is that what is the radial velocity in that direction from the simple rotation model?
There are several.
Several.
You're looking, you know, through a lot of spirals. And this doesn't decorrespond to the main one.
So I see. Okay.
So that worked out. But I was wondering if you had worked out the.
I don't remember.
Galactic rotation.
Yeah, Doc may remember better than that, but I don't remember our argument on that.
Now, the main thing you seem to be concerned with in this paper, besides, of course, just announcing the discovery, is the business of the opacity of the line and the equilibrium between the line temperature and the background temperature, which, of course, is indeed quite important. You work out a, what we would call now an optical depth of one distance. You call it the absorption length.
Yes.
Is that what you meant?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
And I can reproduce those numbers pretty well. You don't mention the observed line width. You mention here you're plugging it in, but you don't give it anywhere in the paper.
Uh-huh.
And do you happen to remember? Do you recall at all the line width that was measured?
No.
These figures I have here, I think, are probably from you and CSIS. I got them actually out of Ort's archive.
Yeah.
And they don't refer to the line width, only the line frequency as a function of time.
Yeah. I don't remember.
Okay, I'll have to try to check that with you and also.
All that's water down, wet far down the river. So.
Something else I always find striking is this thing from the Lyman Laboratory, and here's a fundamental paper on the hydrogen atom.
Yes.
Coming out of there.
See, well, Lyman, Lyman Alpha was first seen in the basement of the old Jefferson lab.
I see.
Lyman's spectrograph was a piece of 4-inch pipe, you know, about that long.
Well, not you had a sort of a pipe stuck out the window.
Yeah, that's true.
The other thing that I find striking is
Well, of course, you see, Lyman, at that point, was director of the laboratory.
Oh, was he?
Yeah.
I see.
And we had to get his permission to stick the thing out the window.
I'm always struck when I look at these two papers in juxtaposition about this is clearly a physicist's paper, and this is clearly an astronomer's paper, or it talks about galactic rotation and so forth, and very little about the physics of the line itself, although, of course, later on he went into it quite a bit. Okay, let's move on. You gave the results of this, as I see it, at two different meetings, an APS meeting in Schenectady and an AAS meeting in Washington, D.C., both in June of 51.
Mm-hmm.
Was that you or Ewan that actually talked?
Well, it was certainly Ewan in the case of the of this one.
The AAS meeting.
AAS meeting. And it was possibly Possibly it was me and the other one, but I'm not. Let's see.
It's given as Ewan and Purcell.
And this was at
Schenectady.
Schenectady. Oh, I'm sure this was Ewan. I don't even remember going to Schenectady for that. I think Doc did.
Okay.
Have, yeah.
Can you recall it all in that first few months after the discovery, when the word was getting out, more or less the reactions of astronomers and or physicists?
Well, again, you see, it's interesting that I knew mostly physicists, and Doc was really our wing among the astronomers.
Right.
I didn't really know many astronomers. One of the first people I told about it, and I remember telling him, was Robbie, who was, of course, very much interested because of all the Columbia background of the hyperfine splitting.
See, who is Robbie? Robbie.
And it was Nathan Nelson there who had measured accurately the ground state hyperfine transition in atomic beans. So that Robbie is one of the very first people I told. In fact, I remember where I told him. This might help to date some things. At the time, I was on the Physical Society Council, and there was a council meeting at the Bureau of Standards, which would have been in connection with the annual APS meeting in Washington then, which was always at the Bureau of Standards in the spring, namely April or
right.
And I remember going to this meeting, and Robbie was already there, and I came in, I sneaked over and told Robbie, I said, we got the 21 centimeter. That must have been just within, a week or two after.
Mm-hmm. Well, concerning the rest frequency of the line, was this a paper that you quote by...
What do we quote?
Cush and Prodell.
Cush and Prodell.
Was that vital to the discovery, or could you have done it as well with just a calculation of the line?
It could have been calculated. I think it could have been calculated with sufficient accuracy at that
Which
time.
Is what von der Holst did in his original paper.
Sure, sure, that's right.
And along the same line, did you have any idea that perhaps this was a way to better measure the frequency of the line in any sense? Or that maybe this could be extended?
No, I don't think we ever seriously thought of that, because by then the atomic beams guys could measure anything. Mm-hmm. And obviously the Doppler shifts and everything that come in, but not...
Of course, now that is happening in molecular spectra, where you can actually get some radicals better than can be done in the laboratory.
Yeah, just because...
They
can't be well produced and nourished. Yeah.
We never...
By then, the atomic beam techniques were coming along so rapidly that precisely...
Well, let's move on to your next touch with astrophysics, I believe it is, correct me if it's wrong, and that is this paper about the 2S2P level in hydrogen and the microwave transitions.
Yes.
Responding to a publication by Wild in which he considered all sorts of lines, and you were pointing out that Giovanelli had done it incorrectly. Do you think that you might have, if this had come out all right, wanted to go and look for this line also? I mean, were you that?
No, we weren't, but the Australians were. They were seriously considering cranking up to look for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I think it was Paul Weil that told me afterward, when they got my paper, they were actually somewhat relieved, because it looked like a pretty hard job anyway, and now they knew they could just forget it.
Right.
Go on.
At 10 gigahertz, too.
Yes, yeah.
I see.
So they...
Along that line, Weil, in his paper, dismisses what we call recombination lines.
That's interesting.
And von der Holst treated them quite a bit in his original paper. I don't know if you've ever seen that.
No.
He said that they look like they might be feasible. Uh-huh. I was wondering, did you ever think about them?
No, never did. And, when they found them, I said, I could kick myself. It seems so obvious an idea. That's right. No, never the wisp of a thought.
Now, you mentioned briefly before, but I'd appreciate it if you could tell me.
It's another example of I have so many examples I can find in my own career, and I'm sure other people can, of a conspicuous lack of foresight, you know.
Well, in hindsight is always the...
Yeah, but I as I said, and I was talking a week or so ago, they had a celebration for Robbie at Columbia, and I gave a little talk. We were supposed to talk on the future of physics. I said, just to establish my credentials as a prophet, I remember distinctly sitting in my office and talking to the head of research at DuPont, who had come up to see me to find out if there was going to be anything in nuclear magnetic resonance for the chemists. And I assured him that there was not.
But when was this?
It must have been about 1947 or 48. It was only about a year before the fine structure was found, you know.
Yeah.
And I told him, well, there's only one thing. I think you could probably use it to measure degree of polymerization, because it was just at the time when our own thoughts were all concentrated on the problem of spin lattice relaxation, and we were beginning to understand the role of molecular motion in it. So I knew you could measure. I said, no, we need big samples, and we just measure the proton line, you know, and stuff.
Okay, well, following the discovery of the line, what was the next step as you saw it? What happened? I mean, you got a discovery. Are you going to follow it up, or what was your attitude?
Well, kept running for a while, of course, but then fairly soon, I can't place it exactly, the center of interest shifted into astronomy, even at Harvard, and this happened with Bach's, I would say, his return. Bach, during this time, you see, Bach was away, as we remember. And although he remembers it, he remembers it differently. At least when he was back there and talked, he remembered in a way what Doc and I were both were sure was wrong on the, you know, where he was at different times relative to the thing.
Mm-hmm.
But
could you just say which?
My impression was that Bart was away, probably in South Africa at the telescope there, you know,
mm-hmm.
in the spring of 51. That when he came back that fall or summer, whenever it was, and found out what was going on, and that then the idea for going into it more seriously at Agassiz Station with making an antenna and so on began to develop. At the same time, there was interest on the part of Merle Tube at the DTM in Washington. And
now, was Ewan looking for someone like Bach that could have some swing in terms of getting a bigger facility? Or you, or was it mainly Bach's initiative?
It was mainly Bach's initiative and Ewan's, I would say. I really played a rather passive role there, except I encouraged everybody.
Yeah.
But I don't remember, you know, doing any of the, as what we would now call, proposal generating for that at all. I had plenty to do at that time. It was a very lively time in the NMR business, so that I wasn't...
So there was no concern?
I did not consider it, let's say, I certainly did not consider turning my own career in that direction in a big way.
And so you were quite content that this was an interesting discovery to let others carry it on?
Yeah, very pleased, in fact, that began to happen, and we used to consult a lot with Bart and about lots of things, about the physics and about the plant. And there was this deal with DTM, in which when the doc did shut down this stuff in Lyman, some of it was shipped off to DTM.
Of that original receiver?
Yeah.
I see.
Right.
And then later he fed other receivers, I think, did he not?
Yeah, that's right.
But I'll talk with him.
Yeah, you talked to him about that.
About that. Is the next time that you are in contact with astrophysics this 1956 paper with George Field? Would you say that's
yes.
fair?
That's right. I'd been this problem in rattling around, and really I should have written it up before, but I was lazy and didn't, had other things to do. And then George's arrival sort of triggered.